Good afternoon, everyone. At the Great Vow Monastery, when they do a Kinhin, the walking meditation, they do the first few minutes like we do, really slow, right? Like walking through molasses. And then they speed up. And you get some, the heart going, you know. I kind of miss that in the afternoons, right?
Time of day.
Yeah, it'd be helpful to be a little more vigorous, I think. So, Kate and I are going to do the same as we did this morning, except we're going to reverse it, and I'll start first, as you can probably tell already. One of the criticisms, I think, that's often made against Buddhism in general is that it focuses on the individual concerns, a kind of Eastern psychotherapy that has really little to offer to help us address the systemic problems that our world faces today. You know, climate breakdown, species extinction, corporate dominance, inequality. And to a large extent, this is true. The way we have come to understand and practice Buddhism in the West, I think really has been limited by what our historical needs and interests have been, particularly from the 1800s up until the present, or almost until the present. And right now is kind of not the time to kind of go into another piece of history and explore the hows and whys of this, that only parts of the Buddhist tradition really got established firmly in the West. But I'd like to consider just one point as an example. If you remember, in around the mid-1800s, Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace published their theories on evolution. And those, together with the new scientific views that, about the universe, they started to spread into the culture at large. And really, many, many people came to doubt or reject the Christian dogma, and started to struggle to find a purpose to life, because the scientific view seemed really cold. And in this kind of painful space that I think society found itself at that time, Buddhist texts that had been translated seemed to offer a way of life that was in harmony with that, with the new and popular scientific views of human nature and the world. So the first popular understanding of the Buddhist tradition saw it as a teaching for the individual to find meaning and ease in her life. Meaning and ease that would not contradict the flow of new understanding about how the world worked. And really, it's continued mostly in that vein even up until today. The Buddhist tradition does offer a path for individual insight into the basic nature of self. That what we hold to be me, or mine, or I, is not really as it seems. And through practice, you know, we touch this kind of intuitive knowledge of love and clarity that lies beneath our kind of ego-driven anxieties and aggressions. Perhaps the key fault, though, of Western Buddhism is to consider that individual healing and transformation is enough. The social issues that are so prevalent have, I think, in this kind of Western Buddhist view, until very recently, basically been ignored or put on the back burner until the individual work is done. This me-first attitude is really limited And it's not one that is really well reflected, I think, in the Buddhist tradition. For example, at the very beginning of the formation of the Sangha in India, the Buddha considered issues about inequality, and he accepted, as Kate mentioned, people of all castes into the Sangha. And as Kate also mentioned, the Buddha ordained women. And while it was true, there are more restrictions placed on nuns that are certainly limiting and unfair from our modern point of view, it was still a revolutionary action on the Buddha's part. The early Buddhist texts also tell us that the Buddha brokered peace agreements. He tried to prevent wars. He tried to ease aggression. Clearly, the Buddha's concerns went beyond the individual and into the social realm. I really think that the Buddha understood, just as we can understand today, that we need both a kind of personal awakening and change and a social awakening and change to fully respond to the dukkha or suffering that's here today. The Buddha repeated many, many times that he teaches the cause of suffering and the way to end suffering. And when we look at suffering, the causes, of course, go way beyond the personal. Early today, I talked about the Bodhisattva vows. And as we heard this morning, the Bodhisattva is one who chooses to stay in this world, in samsara, this world of dukkha and dissatisfaction, to help all sentient beings with their suffering. The Bodhisattva is not just asking, how can I get out of this mess? But how can I make it better for everyone? Everybody knows all those self-help books? It's not like, they don't often emphasize, you know, how can I help other people get out of their mess? They're often like, you know, this is how you can get out of your mess. The Bodhisattva, I think, offers a model of both personal and social awakening and healing. Because isn't it true that we cannot really heal ourselves without healing the world around us? And also true that we cannot heal the world without also healing ourselves. From this Bodhisattva point of view, my well-being, my healing and awakening cannot really be distinguished from the well-being and awakening of others. Because we operate on the understanding that I am not separate from you. Those striving so diligently for awakening, if they lack concern for the suffering of others around them, are really still just caught in the delusion of self, this kind of small self. And the angry and kind of bitter social activists who define who the enemies are and are ready to take action against them have already limited the possibility of profound and lasting transformation. But let's be clear. The Bodhisattva way, indeed all of the Buddhist sutras, offer very little direct advice about what we need to do to create lasting justice, heal the biosphere, end racism and poverty, fix our dysfunctional economic system, or deal with pollution and how we use non-renewable sources of energy. There's nothing. that I have found about what to do with nuclear waste in the Buddha Sutras. The Buddha lived in the Iron Age in India. That's a long time ago. The Iron Age. And knew nothing about the social and environmental issues that face us today. But the Buddhist tradition has much to say about how we approach these problems and what values will aid us in skillfully facing each issue without causing more harm. Let's just pass these out for a moment. So we just handed out a sheet with the 10 clear mind precepts, the 8 noble path, and the 10 paramitas or perfections. And we're not going to examine these in detail, but I wanted you to have a look at them. Maybe it will help in the exercise that we'll be doing a bit later. But mostly to show the various ways that, and these are not all of them by any means, but the kind of qualities that the Buddhist tradition has emphasized. The precepts, the paramitas, the Eightfold Path, give us a foundation for testing the wholesomeness of our actions. In the Buddhist literature, there evolved these lists and many other ones like this. And these lists, I think, really lay the groundwork for clear and skillful action that turns us away from the three poisons of greed, ill will, and delusion. Those three things that we get caught up in, according to the Buddhist analysis. And notice that these lists include not only guidelines on moral or ethical behavior, but also injunctions to be generous, to make constant effort, to develop our awareness, to look deeply into our own hearts again and again and again. The Bodhisattva recognizes interdependence, or as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, interbeing. This paradigm, this understanding, shifts us from a us versus them model to a model, really, that us-them model we know has caused a lot of confusion and suffering. It shifts us from that. And it also, I think, indicates the kind of destructive power of reactive anger and violence. If we recognize interdependence, if we can really see clearly and accept interbeing, then we are not in a war with something that's outside of us. It is, as we mentioned this morning, that place of a kind of absolute view of the precepts. The Bodhisattva and the Bodhisattva path also recognizes delusion, or rather than some kind of evil or some unremitting bad force or bad person. That all of us in varying degrees are caught up in greed or ill will or ignorance, those roots of dukkha or suffering. And here, I think, the Bodhisattva practicality or pragmatism can help cut through any kind of ideologies or hardened stances that we have. One of the paramitas, the bottom list there, is lists upaya, or skillful means. So this, reflecting that kind of expansive view of the precepts, for example, helps, I think, us to cultivate creative ways to face each situation, because each situation has its own unique qualities. How we understand suffering, whether it is, you know, something outside of us, something evil, something bad, or as delusion, something that we all share, shapes how we respond to the world. The Buddhist understanding of these roots of suffering, I think, give us a wider perspective also on the social suffering that we see around us today. David Loy, who's a philosopher and a Zen teacher and will be giving a kind of workshop here in a few weeks, has written about the institutionalization of greed, delusion, and ill will in a number of publications. And I like to read you a couple of quotes from him just to give you a taste of his approach and using this Buddhist analysis to look at something larger than the individual, but looking at institutions. And again, these are just quotes. He gives much more detail in full pieces of writing. So here's David Loy. He says, what is greed? He said, one definition is never enough. On the individual level, it is the next thing one buys that will fill up one's sense of lack. But greed works just as well to describe what happens on an institutional level. Corporations are never large enough or profitable enough. The value of their shares is never high enough. Our national GDP is never big enough. In fact, we cannot imagine what big enough may be. It is built into these systems that they must keep growing or else they tend to collapse. But why is it always better if it can never be enough? It's the same with ill will. One example of ill will at work is the punitive legal system of the USA, he's American, which incarcerates vast numbers of people, mostly those on low incomes and people of color. White-collar criminals rarely end up in prison, at least not for very long. And he goes on, a little different quote, but again about ill will. He says, an even more forceful example is our obsession with the military spending and the weaponization of security. Measured by the power of its armed forces and the resources that are devoted to them, the U.S. is the most militarized society in world history. And what about the third of the three poisons, delusion? The Buddha literally means the awakened one, which implies that the rest of us are unawakened. Each of us lives lives inside our own dreamlike bubble of delusions, which distort our perceptions and expectations. And Buddhist practitioners are familiar with this problem, yet all of us live inside a larger bubble that determines how we understand the world and ourselves collectively. The institution that is most responsible for molding our collective sense of self is the media, which has become a kind of, he quotes, international nervous system. He says, since they are profit-making institutions whose bottom line is based on advertising revenue, their main concern is to do whatever it takes to maximize those profits. It's not in their best interest to question the grip of consumerism itself. And he gives many more examples, but those are just a few that I want to kind of touch upon. I think I'd like to kind of conclude by adding one more key point about the Bodhisattva and about vowing. In these challenging times that we live, we're often dazed by the kind of negative developments that we read about, maybe experience. And I think are overwhelmed by the magnitude of what needs to be done to heal this world. Despair hovers close by. The Bodhisattva's vow to liberate all living beings from greed, ill will, and delusion is woven with the understanding of the absolute view of the precepts, that there is no other. In this way, there's no goal that defines success or failure. There's no goal that defines success or failure. The Bodhisattva just does the best she can without knowing what the result will be. In our Zen tradition, we call this don't know mind. And somehow, in this confused world, and maybe I should say despite our greed, hate, and delusion, slavery is no longer accepted. Apartheid ended. And according to one study that I read about in the newspaper recently, in this last decade, there have been fewer conflicts than in any time in modern history. There is good news. But the Bodhisattva really doesn't get caught by bad news or good news. We know the job is limitless. And that can be a kind of strength. We just go forward. We just go forward. So there is much work to do for our own healing and the healing of the world. And the Bodhisattva knows that both are needed, and also knows one cannot happen without the other. So I'll pause here and...
Part two. I was just thinking, listening to Michael's talk, how often I really do call on these these not only principles but practices. Each of these elements of the Eightfold Path and the paramitas, and we could also have added to this the Brahma Viharas or noble abodes, loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. We could have added those to these lists as not only qualities that we cultivate in ourselves, but actual mindfulness practices that really buoy us up on the rough seas of life. And the one that was really coming up for me was patience of the paramitas. Patience being sometimes hard to access, you know, when it seems like people just don't learn, like we ourselves just don't learn, and people around us and people in the world just don't learn. But when we feel that way, really, we're taking a short view, and we have to really practice loving kindness and patience when that comes up. So I just want to say that how really meaningful I find these practices in my just daily life. Just, you know, saying, okay, that one is what I need right now, or that one is what I need right now. some of what I'm going to say is just kind of we ran out of time to to really sink in our afternoon talks with each other as much as the morning, but so I feel like it's a little bit of a dialogue, and some of what I'll say will be complementary and supplementary. This morning, we saw that in earlier times, the practice of the precepts was often seen in terms of individual karma, karmic rewards and karmic debits, and was often reduced to a kind of acquisitive effort to gain personal merit in a favorable rebirth. With the possibility out in the far, far distant future of, after many lifetimes, stepping off the wheel of life and death. That was the path that was called the Arhat's path. And as we've talked about the difference, the Bodhisattva path, and the way it offers a different model and a different motivation for guiding our speech and our action. And at this point, what I'd like to do is speculate that this model of the Bodhisattva path and the role of compassion as a non-separateness from others as a motivating force might be part of a larger evolution in human religious and philosophical thought and practice. I don't know how many of you read Karen Armstrong, who's a religious historian, and she talks about teachings of compassion coming in to different religious traditions around the same time of the rise of the Mahayana and then in Christianity and other traditions as well. Though I would be cautious about engaging in a kind of social Darwinism that says, oh, well, these cultures are more advanced than those cultures in that regard, because there are indigenous cultures, some still extant today, that that have very strong ethics of mutual support and kindness built in, and I'll talk about this a little bit tomorrow when I talk about justice and compassion. But what I want to question is the utility of using fear of after-death punishment as a deterrent to behavior, you know, our behavior that's driven by greed, hatred, and ignorance. Whether that fear is of eternal hellfire and damnation or of karmic retribution in a future life. Based on my less than exhaustive knowledge of human history over the past several millennia, I don't see much persuasive evidence that fear of punishment works. Do you?
Sure. Keeps involved in life.
Within limits, usually pretty short term. We humans aren't even curbed that much by fear of punishment in this life, let alone speculative eternity or future. For one thing, when we're in the grip of strong states of greed, desire, anxiety, anger, those states of actual, you know, physiological, neurological arousal override our better judgment, override our best intentions and aspirations. And our view of consequences, karmic or otherwise, becomes pretty short-sighted. We also, as humans, have a stunningly self-focused capacity for denial. When we gamble that we won't get caught and have to suffer the consequences of our behavior. Consider just for a moment the behavior of the Canadian Senate members who have been featured in the news recently. This habit of denial applies to our individual behaviors, and it's magnified by our group or collective habit patterns. It's even easier to deny responsibility for our individual choices when everybody else is doing it. Right? Consider how we behave, how we behave after getting caught for speeding or not coming to a full stop at a stop sign. Perhaps we feel personally offended that we got caught and all those other people didn't. For a while afterwards, we're careful, particularly around the location where we were caught. But over time, our caution erodes. We're in a hurry, we're surrounded by others driving carelessly, and we start to push those limits again. I've noticed that what really motivates me to be attentive and cautious when I'm driving is not fear of the hefty fine, although there's one spot that I do watch myself. But I have small driving vows. Not to run yellow and red lights. Not to drive too fast on country roads at night. And these are motivated by my intention not to hit a pedestrian, not to hit a deer or a raccoon crossing the street, crossing the country road at night. These small vows have large potential consequences, and they require continuous renewal. Even more so because they go against the stream of our culture of hurry and distraction. So we have many little small vows of intention that require almost daily renewal because habits are so strong. What I'm getting at here is ultimately that the deepest and most effective motivator of our behavior is non-separateness, is compassion, the fellow feeling of other beings, live beings that we feel resonating in our own bodies, motivates our vows not to do harm and to be of benefit. The realization of the bodhisattva is that, as we've said, there is no individual salvation because the true nature of our being is inextricably interconnected with all other beings. Not even in the present, but throughout space and time. So those little micro vows carry forward infinitely through the future and oddly in the past too. So we are awakening together with all beings, and the consequences of our behavior flow onward and outward without limit. Even the smallest of our actions make a difference, and this is the law of karma. Seeing deeply into the truth of our nature, the barriers of self-clinging fall away. This is how morality, right conduct, arises from meditation and wisdom, the three legs of the tripod. Just as many Christians today don't take heaven and hell as literal locations for our future reward or punishment, but as figurative descriptions of human mind states, perhaps we don't have to ascribe to a literal view of reincarnation to appreciate the workings of karma. That concept of, and we don't usually talk about this in Zen very much. Zen doesn't really emphasize reincarnation as such. But this concept of a linear progression of an individual through successive lifetimes has always seemed to me a little hard to reconcile with the Buddhist teaching of non-self. If there's no self, what is there to be reincarnated? I once attended a week-long retreat with Alan Wallace, quite a renowned American teacher and writer on Tibetan Buddhism, who confided to us that he had gone through a period of some doubt over exactly this point. Tibetan Buddhism, unlike Zen, really holds reincarnation as quite a central tenet. And I was surprised to hear Wallace say that he eventually concluded that this belief in reincarnation in that kind of classical way was essential to Buddhist practice, because otherwise, what would be our motivation to behave? Behave wholesomely. Or not. The Buddha himself, while he did certainly make reference to reincarnation because it was a belief in his culture, was also reluctant to be pinned down about metaphysical questions. And he once told a questioner, and here I'm going to be quite liberal in my paraphrasing, he once replied, "If I really told you the true vastness and complexity of the reality I have seen, you wouldn't comprehend it. So I refrain from trying to answer you." This is a man who was trying to pin the Buddha down on what happens after death and what happened before the universe began. The Buddha allowed the vast mystery of the universe, allowed for the vast mystery, and I'm glad that our Zen practice does too. I'm glad that our practice helps us to penetrate that habitual dualistic way we have of thinking, us and them, right and wrong, black and white, life and death, samsara and nirvana, and to glimpse even in moments that when separation drops away, as the great Japanese Rinzai Zen master Hakuin wrote, "Nirvana is right here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land, this very body, the Buddha." So again, I've kind of gone into a little historical background in order to illustrate how the precepts and our understanding of them are in a process of evolution. Apparently, of ongoing evolution. Apparently, Thich Nhat Hanh's Order of Interbeing has actually issued a contemporary update of the Vinaya precepts, the very traditional old precepts, which include not playing with computer games and not singing karaoke. Another manifestation of this evolution is what's being called engaged Buddhism, which combines contemporary perspectives on Buddhism, Western values of social and environmental justice, as well as the perspectives offered by science, to guide our response to social and ecological justice issues. So our conversations today are part of an evolution. And this afternoon we'll look at how we can apply some of these perspectives to our collective ethical life in the world today. With most of these issues, like Michael said, we're not going to find some definitive Buddhist stance. There is no Buddhist Pope laying down the rules for all Buddhists. Even though I've encountered people who think that that's what the Dalai Lama is. And I've had to say, well, actually, he's just the head of one of the Tibetan Buddhist sects, not the whole world of Buddhism. But he has world stature because of who he is and how he teaches. Moral standards and behaviors in the Buddhist world actually vary considerably according to different cultures. influenced by both secular culture and non-Buddhist spiritual traditions within each of those cultures. And an example of that would be the Japanese Buddhist support for the military clique that drove Japan into World War II, who were influenced quite strongly by Confucian thinking, as well as a not a well-rounded approach to Buddhist ethics. Maybe you could say they were stuck in the absolute perspective of there's no killer and no killed. No life, no death. That so we must be warriors with a pure sword that cuts through duality. So it's easy to take Dharma teachings and distort them or use them in a sort of contaminated way, a self-serving way, a collectively self-serving way. And although Buddhist practitioners, monks and nuns and lay people, have certainly engaged in social welfare and social service activities throughout Buddhist history, schools, building bridges, healthcare, Buddhist thought on the whole doesn't really discuss collective ethical behavior and responsibilities. Justice is not a topic you'll find in the index of themes in the Pali Canon. And I'll talk more about this tomorrow. But we can be guided, as Michael's just said, by the Dharma teachings in our practice, to fully avow. We started our chant of the when we chanted the precepts at noon service with the repentance verse, all my ancient twisted karma. And I often chant it, all our ancient twisted karma, because we are completely interconnected in our karmic lives. All our ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born from body, speech, and mind, we now fully avow. So we can do that. We can fully avow the complexity of our present situation in terms of human rights, justice, social and ecological responsibility. So let me just get you started with an example, and we're going to try and do in our small groups is really look at specific areas. But an example would be the ethical treatment of animals, wild animals and domestic animals. Buddhist teachings give us a basis for considering the welfare of animals in the ethic of non-harming being extended to all living things. Also, we can be guided by our view of the interdependence of all beings. There are many stories in Buddhist folklore that teach kindness to animals. And the Tibetan Buddhists say that any animal could have been our mother or father in a past life. And the way I like to think that, one way I like to think about that is just thinking of my body, the elements, the molecules in my body. How many other beings' bodies have they passed through, you know? Like the actual substance of me is made up of many other beings, plants and animals, earth, water, fire, and air, right? But we also find practices particularly practiced in Chinese culture today, such as buying caged birds. Have you heard of this? Buying caged birds, fish, turtles, and then releasing them. So public animal releases. Ostensibly is an act of kindness, but it's very, again, it's that effort to get karmic merit. Well, if I release 2,000 birds, I'll get this much merit.
It will make up for the rhinoceros you have to kill.
Right. Yeah. Do we gather up rhinoceroses, you know, and release them from their suffering? So, and not to mention the well-being of these animals that are released. Some of the animals are actually raised and caged to be released. And being released does not guarantee their well-being upon release, particularly if they're not released in an ecologically supportive environment.
Well-being of hawks and crows.
So, in modern Buddhist cultures, where Buddhism is, you know, the main tradition, Thailand and Japan, for example, just like our own, consumer values often trump the well-being of wild animals and the ecosystems that support them. Buddhist cultures are inconsistent when it comes to the practice of vegetarianism. The Buddha himself did not take an absolute stance. Those who took the precepts were prohibited from killing animals or from receiving meat that had been expressly killed for them. But when offered meat in their begging bowls that was not expressly killed for them, they were to accept that as food. Indian culture has a long history of vegetarianism from pre-Buddhist times, but the harsher climates of Tibet and China have resulted in more cultural tolerance for meat eating among lay people and sometimes among monks as well. In Japan, monks training in monasteries will eat vegetarian food, but when they go outside the monastery, they often eat fish, which is a staple of Japanese diet. So how do we here in the West negotiate the complexities of our relationship to the plants and animals that provide our sustenance in a way that minimizes their suffering and maximizes their well-being? Even the strictest of vegans have to take a good look at the creatures that are killed in agriculture to raise soybeans. How do we bring that to our awareness with conscious gratitude and appreciation and sorrow? So, how do we support endangered species? Do we kill rats that have overrun an island population of endangered breeding birds? And what about feral cats, not to mention our own dear pets, who kill thousands and thousands and thousands of songbirds every year? Songbirds are really in trouble these days. How do we take responsibility for the imbalances in ecosystems produced by human activities? How do the precepts support us to make the best decisions we can, knowing our decisions are provisional, knowing they're not perfect, knowing that sometimes our decisions are contaminated by our own fear and greed, but still we make decisions. Still, we bring as much awareness as possible to those decisions. And then we stay open and flexible and ready to revise our views and our strategies. I think this is the great gift of our practice, is that it's dynamic, and it teaches us not to stick in our views, not to stick in our behaviors, always to look deeply, always to look widely with kindness and patience and wisdom. So I think that's where I will stop.